Blog Talk Radio. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Wild Horse and Burro Radio, an educational outreach program of Wild Horse Freedom Federation. Before I introduce our guest this morning, I want to make a real quick announcement and remind all of you that there's language in the 2018 budget that would allow almost 50,000 wild horses and burros in BLM holding facilities and tens of thousands more on our public lands to be euthanized. Please be sure to call your U.S. senators and let them know you do not want our wild horses and burros to be killed, euthanized, or sterilized, and that you do not want horse slaughterhouses to be allowed in the United States. Our guest today is Carrie Gillum, an investigative journalist, a former senior correspondent for Reuters International News Service, and a research director for U.S. Right to Know, a consumer group whose mission is pursuing truth and transparency in America's food system. Carrie is also a board member of Justice Pesticides and a contributor to Huffington Post. Carrie is also the author of the newly published book, Whitewash. And I have to tell all of you, this is one of the most important books I have ever read in my life. It's an amazing book. And for our listeners that usually listen to our show, which covers public lands issues, I wanted to mention that glyphosate and 2,4-D are used widely on public lands by the Bureau of Land Management. Welcome to the show, Carrie.
Thank you. Thanks for being here, and thank you for the kind words.
Yeah, well, it's the truth. So, Carrie, for people who may be new to this topic, can you describe glyphosate? Tell them what it is.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's not a common household term, is it?
But no.
you probably know it as Roundup. I mean, glyphosate is really the active ingredient. It's a weed killer. It's an herbicide, an herbicidal agent. And Monsanto brought it to market in 1974. And it's been heralded, you know, as sort of the safest and most effective herbicide, you know, that we've ever had. And it is the most widely used herbicide now in history. And as you said, it's used on public lands. It's used by people in their, you know, on their homes and lawns and gardens. It's used in city parks and school playgrounds. Utilities use it around their facilities. And, of course, farmers use it around the world on their fields and on many crops, you know, to produce our food. Monsanto uses it in branded Roundup products, but it's also used by other companies in hundreds of other products. It's an incredibly pervasive pesticide that has really just left a huge and what I lay out in the book, a very damaging footprint across our landscape.
In the entire globe, too. I mean, in the entire world, it's used
right.
in other countries. But
it's
I think
the world.
You mentioned it's used in the north, in the Americas, the most.
Right.
Can you tell our listeners how there's formulations that include surfactants, and just explain what surfactants do?
Well, sure. So the surfactants, glyphosate is the active ingredient, but it's not sold alone. It's sold in what we call formulated products like Roundup mm-hmm. that you pick up in your lawn and garden store is a formulated product, and it contains other chemicals, such things as surfactants, which are used to help glyphosate essentially get into the plant, stick to the plant, and then penetrate the leaves of the plant. So there's quite a bit of evidence and research that this combination of glyphosate and surfactants is more toxic than just glyphosate alone.
Is Monsanto considered an endocrine disruptor, or what do we know about Monsanto from the truly independent tests?
Yeah, so glyphosate and Roundup, there are concerns, and there has been research that indicates that this could be considered an endocrine disruptor, and that is sort of a key concern with a lot of pesticides, because they can do damage, you know, to DNA. Those are sort of cancer indicators when they're changing chromosomes and affecting your DNA. So, you know, it's a real concern. Our EPA and our federal government and European regulators are all trying to learn more and have a better understanding about this science, not just for glyphosate, of course, but for other pesticides that are in use. Chemical companies have really been pushing back on this type of inquiry and research and really not wanting our federal regulators to probe too deeply into whether or not they're chemicals or endocrine disruptors. So that's an area of debate and discussion right now. Just one of many factors that's concerning about this widespread pesticide use in our world.
And in your book, actually I learned, I didn't know a lot of what I read in your book, but can you kind of explain Monsanto's GE crops, how that came about, and then about Monsanto telling farmers to spray Roundup directly onto the crops before harvest?
Yeah, definitely. So when they introduced glyphosate, when Monsanto introduced glyphosate, they had a patent on this chemical. And, you know, farmers loved it, you know, everybody loved it, and they had strong sales. And this really became an important bread and butter product for Monsanto. This, of course, was 70s and 1980s. They were in trouble then with some of the other things that they had. PCBs, in particular, lawsuits were popping up. You know, the damaging impacts of Monsanto and PCBs was becoming known. And so they really were trying to shift to become an agricultural company. And as the patent neared expiration in the year, it was to expire in the year 2000, Monsanto was wanting to expand as an agricultural company. But it also wanted to make sure it had a way to hold on to that glyphosate market, which is, you know, billions of dollars a year. So they very ingeniously developed these genetically engineered crops. In the mid-1990s, they introduced these that could tolerate being sprayed with glyphosate. Essentially, they were immune to glyphosate. Glyphosate or Roundup, they could spray it on the fields. The weeds would die, but the crops wouldn't. You know, and how great was that for farmers? Made their job a lot easier. And Monsanto called these Roundup Ready crops. So Roundup Ready soybeans, Roundup Ready corn. They rolled these out and said, hey, use these with Roundup. And farmers said, yeah, that is great for me. So even though the patent expired in the year 2000, what we've seen is that Monsanto's market share for glyphosate and Roundup, you know, has really expanded and continued to be strong for them. So genetically engineered crops, while they want to talk about, and they often do, you know, these help feed the world and they have all these wonderful traits that are beneficial to humanity, the main GMO crop planted then and planted now is the type that is herbicide tolerant, that can be sprayed directly with Roundup or glyphosate. So it's, you know, it's been a real financial win for Monsanto and other chemical companies who license the traits and sell these types of chemicals. But yeah, you ask about spraying it directly over the crops. So yeah, with GMO crops, GMO corn and soy and canola and cotton and sugar beet and alfalfa, you know, they spray it directly over the crops. Now, they use glyphosate in production of over 100 different food crops. And some of those, even though they're not GMOs, Monsanto has indicated they can also be sprayed directly, like wheat and barley and oats in particular, before they're harvested to help kind of dry them out or desiccate them. And again, you know, it's useful sometimes to farmers, but what happens is this leaves pretty high residues, traces of the weed killer in our foods, you know, and FDA scientists and others have found glyphosate residues in oatmeal products, you know, that you feed your kids, baby oatmeal. They found it in honey samples. Glyphosate residues have been found in cereals and snacks and in our drinking water and in our own urine. So again, you know, as I lay out in the book, this has become just pervasive in our environment.
Yeah, and it's even been found in breast milk, right?
Yeah, there are some studies that have indicated that it can be found in breast milk. Of course, Monsanto has helped arrange and fund some other studies that say that, no, that's not the case. But more independent research has indicated that, yes, it can be the case. So, you know, our government, unfortunately, doesn't really want to dig into this and has been reluctant to do testing or to require testing. So, you know, in terms of official government position and regulatory position on this, it's really vague and not established at this point.
And aren't they having to use more and more glyphosate on the plants, more and more of it, all the increasing?
Yeah. So what we've seen is, you know, in the mid-1990s, they were using it, farmers and others around North America were using about 40 million pounds on average a year is sort of the number. And now it's about 300 million pounds a year. So, the, you know, as we said, the use just surged dramatically after the introduction of this, these GMO crops. Part of the reason that we've seen the increase is because, it's, you know, it's a treadmill. As farmers use more of it, weeds become resistant. It's like antibiotic resistance. You use it too much and it loses its effectiveness. So farmers use it a lot. The weeds become resistant. So farmers use more to try to, you know, pour two or three times more of this on the weeds. But weeds continue to become more resistant. It's just this vicious cycle. And so now, just recently, the companies, Monsanto and the others, have said, well, we'll just combine glyphosate with dicamba, or we'll combine it with 2,4-D, other chemicals, you know, other herbicides, and we'll have new GMO crops that will tolerate all of those herbicides, and we'll spray that on those. So that's where we are now. We just keep upping the ante, you know,
but those
pesticides
are very toxic, too. Yeah, there's a lot of problems with those.
Right.
There could be a lot of health risks with those. So
right. They've long been considered, you know, much more harmful than glyphosate, for sure. So,
Carrie, what were the findings about glyphosate by the World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer? That's the IARC. I think, didn't they do issue some findings in, like, 2015?
Yeah, they sure did. And that was, you know, I've been, you know, a journalist for Reuters, the international news agency, you know, worked there for 17 years. And that's how I started really covering this issue, because it was my job to write about food and ag and Monsanto. And so I could see over the years the research building that showed harm with this chemical. And in 2015, the International Agency for Research on Cancer included glyphosate as one of the substances that it was going to review. And they do this, you know, every year, different substances. They take a look at the research that is out there and kind of weigh in on, well, what does this have carcinogenic potential? So they did that with glyphosate in 2015. You know, it made sense. Why hadn't they done it before? I mean, again, this is the most widely used herbicide in the world. So they took a look at epidemiology reports and toxicology reports and, you know, different exposure reports that had come out of different countries, or DNA. People who'd been exposed, they were able to look at their DNA and they saw breaks in the DNA strands. And they looked at a wide range of published peer-reviewed research and determined, and they put it all into a matrix. You know, they looked at studies that found no links to cancer, and they saw a lot of studies that did show links. So they put it all together and decided that it was a probable human carcinogen, and that was their rating. And that came out in March of 2015. So, you know, that's been a real eye-opener, because even though the research was already out there and they didn't do new research, just to put it all together and say this is what you know, we need to be watching this and we need to be concerned about this. It's probably a huge
percentage. And weren't some of the best scientists in the world on this IARC?
Yeah, I mean, that's how they do it. It's the World Health Organization. They bring in, they don't have people who sit and work there every day. What they do is they invite in global experts and people who are not affiliated with industry, you know, who have no financial ties or relationships to any of the chemicals or any of the findings that they might come out with, and from countries all around the world, and they have them, you know, go over the research.
Yeah.
So it's about the most independent view you're ever going to get.
Yeah. Didn't they notice there was a rise in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma? Was that discussed in their group?
Yeah. So when they looked at the cancer connections, they found the most positive linkage to non-Hodgkin lymphoma, a type of blood cancer. And again, that's not saying it definitely causes non-Hodgkin lymphoma. They say it probably causes cancer with a noted positive association with non-Hodgkin lymphoma. So that is where we see all of these lawsuits. You know, thousands of people are suing Monsanto who have non-Hodgkin lymphoma, alleging that they developed this disease from exposure to Roundup. You know, there's some 3,500 people suing the company right now.
Well, and being the great journalist you are, you've actually gone out and talked with farmers themselves. What have they told you about glyphosate? I was really touched by the farmers themselves, what they told you.
Well, sure. And this is, I mean, of course, that's what you do. You're a journalist. And these people are, you know, the boots on the ground, the people on the front lines, the people who are using it and experiencing it, and some of them developing the diseases or the health ailments, and some of them not. And, I mean, it directly, use of this chemical has been a very important factor in their livelihood, you know. So I've spent, lots and lots of time and lots of farm fields around the country, around the U.S. But, I mean, it depends. The consensus, I would say, from farmers is that it doesn't work like it used to. You know, so setting aside the question of whether or not it causes cancer, glyphosate is you know, diminishing in its importance because it no longer is as effective as it used to be. They have to use more of it, or they have to use it in combination with other herbicides. So the duration of this chemical and its pervasiveness in our world, you know, it's not going to go away tomorrow, but it's certainly probably not going to be something that we can rely on for 20 to 30 more years. And then when you lay on top of that the health concerns, it really does make it clear that we need to explore other options. And the book tries to make the case that rather than simply looking for new combinations of synthetic pesticides that we can, you know, combine and increase our volumes and pour it on everything that we touch and everything that we eat, you know, there are other options, traditional methods to grow food and to deal with weeds that are safer and more sustainable and better for the soil, and better for biodiversity. So it's really, the book is just trying to be a wake-up call to say, hey, we need to get back in balance, you know, and look at the risks as well as the rewards and bring some balance back into our environment before we just destroy it and destroy our health.
One thing that really stood out to me was that one farmer said that he could use this soap vinegar and salt, and it worked as well. Anyhow, you know, we know how widely glyphosate is now used in the U.S. and other countries. What happened when members of parliament had their urine tested?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, so... So it's a really big debate right now over this chemical in Europe, because the license to keep it on the market expires December 15th, you know, in just a month from now, less than a month from now. So European Parliament members and European Commission members are really trying to understand the science and the safety and the implications for farming. So this was, what, a year or so ago? European Parliament members had their urine tested, not all of them, but many of them, to see if they had glyphosate indeed in their own bodies. And they were quite alarmed to find that, yes, they do have it. That seems to resonate with people. I've been tested. I have it. You probably have it. I think anybody who eats probably has a little bit of this weed killer to be found in your body. So, the European Parliament has been influenced and recently did vote to ban glyphosate in Europe. Now, that's not a binding decision. So we still are seeing debate and discussion in Europe over what to do about this chemical. Not as much debate and discussion here in the United States. We seem to not have quite as much of a precautionary view, I think, as our Europeans do.
Yeah. What government agency regulates? Oh, and just before we get off the topic of the European Parliament members that had their urine tested, it was kind of like a campaign. The ones that would, there was a hashtag #MePee. It was kind of funny.
Right.
Their slogans were in all those old campaigns. What government agency regulates the use of glyphosate here in the U.S.?
So it's the Environmental Protection Agency, which has primary responsibility here for making sure that pesticides, and other chemicals that are out there in the environment are safe. The Office of there's an Office of Pesticide Programs within the EPA, and they work with companies like Monsanto and others to take them through a process, in which they're supposed to submit research and make sure that these products are used in a way and labeled in a way that will protect the public and protect the environment. But what we've seen in the documents and what I lay out in the book is that quite often you see, the public safety issue get, really downplayed, and the corporate profit issue really get priority. So signs of harm, evidence of concern, even the EPA's own scientists, are often raising red flags and saying we need to be concerned about this, but you see time and again, corporate influence, wins out and wins the day. And I think you see that, across industries, right, and across issues.
One thing that really surprised me in your book, I think you mentioned that the EPA doesn't even test for glyphosate residues in food.
Well, not,
or maybe
not
the
EPA.
USDA.
USDA does not test for glyphosate residues in foods. Now, they test for hundreds of other pesticides every single year. They test about 10,000 food samples for hundreds of pesticide residues, not glyphosate, even though it's the most widely used in the world. They did one sampling project in 2011 of 300 soybean samples, and they found that most of them had glyphosate in them. And then they decided not to do any more testing. And the FDA, similarly, has not done any testing. It also tests every year thousands of food products for hundreds of different pesticides. They've steadfastly avoided testing for glyphosate. They started a little program in 2016 after the IARC ruling on carcinogenicity. They started a little sampling program in 2016. One of their chemists is the one who brought in oatmeal products and said, wow, look, there's glyphosate in all these oatmeal products. And looked at honey, brought in honey samples and found glyphosate in all these honey samples. And, well, lo and behold, the FDA stopped the testing program and actually took FDA chemist off of the testing. So,
And I think you mentioned in your book that even trying to find a lab, because these agrochemical companies are big clients of these labs, wasn't it hard to even find someone that would test the food for you independently?
So there are, independent labs, if we're not talking FDA or USDA labs, that do, food testing for companies. And some consumer groups wanted to start testing foods. And it was very hard for them to find labs who would cooperate, but there are now two or three around the country that are, and food companies are awakening to this. I've met with them not too long ago, and they're very concerned because consumers, they know consumers know, or they're starting to know, you know, that not only this pesticide, but others are routinely showing up in foods and that consumers are concerned. And so food companies are starting to see the writing on the wall, starting to see that they need, you know, to seek out healthier food options for their customers. So that's a good thing, I think.
Does the EPA use its own studies on glyphosate, or does it rely on Monsanto's studies?
Yeah, so the EPA doesn't do any studies on glyphosate or any of these other pesticides. They rely on the registrants, really, to bring them the body of research that they, you know, need to check all the boxes to say that they have looked at, you know, safety studies on this stuff. Now, they also are supposed to and often, you know, do, in fact, look at literature, do literature reviews and look at other studies that are out there. But when you look specifically at glyphosate, you see, you know, that most of the studies that have informed their decision to say that glyphosate is safe have come from the chemical industry, Monsanto and others in the chemical industry.
Well, and then Monsanto's studies are unpublished. Is that correct?
Trade secret confidential information. So a lot of the things that they have submitted in their registration package, right, they're not published, they're not peer-reviewed, they're not available for other independent scientists or members of the public to analyze them. And that's the same way it's been in Europe. And, of course, that's a real problem for critics because for something that's so pervasive that it's in our food and it's in our own bodies, we – you know, many people don't think that the science should be secret.
Yeah, I think it needs to be peer-reviewed and the public should be aware, you know, what the test showed. Can you give us some examples of how Monsanto and other agrochemical companies have influenced the decisions of the EPA?
Yeah, I mean, gosh, well, you can, I would say you could write a whole book
about
it.
Yeah, there's a lot. Yeah. Well, let's start with the ghostwriting.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I mean, what we've seen, so part of my work, you know, is I keep referring to documents here as we're speaking, but is obtaining documents from within the EPA and the USDA and the FDA. And the group I work for, U.S. Right to Know, we've obtained thousands of documents from public universities that work with Monsanto and others. And then, of course, there are thousands more documents that have come out through this litigation, discovery documents, internal Monsanto emails and memos and reports that have really been, you know, eye-opening and revealing. And when you put all of this this documentation together, much of it, you know, Monsanto's own communications internally or to regulators, you do see a clear kind of picture of efforts to suppress information, to manipulate information, to, you know, promote, of course, their message of safety while suppressing or diminishing evidence of harm. So part of what we've seen them talk about doing is what they call ghostwriting. These are Monsanto's terms, ghostwriting, where they will be working on a paper, a research paper, or something that will say, you know, glyphosate is safe and there's no reason to be worried about it, but they really want it to appear as though it's coming from independent scientists, not from Monsanto, and they call that ghostwriting. And there are different papers that the EPA has looked at and relied on that Monsanto refers to as having ghostwritten. So, you know, that's very concerning. We also see them drafting and writing, you know, statements or articles or blogs or things like that, that again appear to come from sort of independent scientists and will be, you know, appear on in magazines or websites. And then you can see in the documents where Monsanto's own people have actually written it. There was a pretty famous or not famous, I guess, but an interesting case with Forbes magazine that was detailed in the documents where, you know, this person who appears to be independent and authoritative has these articles in Forbes magazine, and you see in the documents where Monsanto is basically emailing him the draft article of what, you know, they want it to look like he has written to appear in Forbes magazine. So Forbes magazine has pulled those articles now from their website.
Oh, good.
And
good.
Said that they have severed
good.
Their relationship with him. But these examples
oh,
just go on and on and on. And
mm-hmm,
they
mm-hmm.
prepare presentations for professors at universities. I mean, it's extremely advanced.
Yeah.
An advanced
don't
network.
They even, yeah, don't they even, like, write policy for people working at the EPA? You know, they have their hand in policy
well,
writing, too.
They, you know, one interesting memo was right after the IARC, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, decision with glyphosate. We have an email from a Monsanto executive emailing an EPA talking point, you know, for what
mm-hmm.
they want the EPA to say about IARC. And you see them emailing an official there asking for help, essentially, in and information in dealing with another glyphosate review and wanting
mm-hmm.
that review to go away, being very concerned about that review and wanting it to go away. And they got the EPA to help
mm-hmm.
them make that go away. So,
yeah.
You know, there's...
Yeah.
It's worth mentioning the Office of Inspector General. This is not just sort of, you know, critics saying, oh, we think there's collusion. The Office of Inspector General has launched an investigation into potential collusion
mm-hmm.
between Monsanto and the EPA because of the documents and all the things that have come out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was one of the most interesting things to me, because these scientists were claiming to be independent, but I think you said that Monsanto was funneling money to them through what, unrestricted grants or unrestricted gifts,
right?
Like at the university,
yeah.
The Florida Foundation, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, what you see is Monsanto money, and again, I mean, other chemical companies, other companies. It's not unusual to provide research dollars to public universities. Sadly, in the United States, you know, we don't have, you know, the wealth of public funding for universities.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of corporate money that flows into these. And of course, then the corporate hand, you wonder if that influences research. And what we've seen through the documents is that at different universities around the United States, we've certainly seen that happen. And the University of Florida was one really sort of egregious example. They were working with a professor there named Kevin Folta, funneling money
mm-hmm.
to him. You see him in the emails telling them to send it through a foundation where it won't have to be publicly reported. You see
mm-hmm.
them talking about presentations and policy briefs that he could write. He's been on a website called GMO Answers, you know, dozens and dozens of
mm-hmm.
times. And you can see in the documents sometimes where Monsanto PR people have written the commentary that, you know, looks like it came from him that goes
mm-hmm.
up on this website.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
you know, taking money, not disclosing the money, then, you know, working, using words that come from Monsanto, making them appear as though your own. Like, that's just, it's not fair to the public. It's not transparent. It's not truthful.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
don't they also have front groups that are pushing the agenda of the agrochemical companies?
Oh, yeah. So there are a lot of organizations we found that, again, you know, nonprofit groups that are set up and have websites and things and appear to be sort of independent policy, you know, advisory or policy think tanks or commentary, scientific commentary organizations. And, you know, Monsanto or other chemical industry players, you know, are helping to fund it or helping to direct it or helping to, you know, determine what should be written about. And there are many of those. And, you know, it's
mm-hmm.
smart, right, on their part, because
mm-hmm.
if you see something come out of Monsanto, you're going to, like, suspect, well, that probably has a Monsanto bias to it. But if you see it come out of an organization...
Yeah, but
if you see it come out of an organization that sounds like academics review, that sounds very sciencey and everything, and you think, oh, well, that
mm-hmm.
must be independent. But what you see
mm-hmm.
in the emails is Monsanto talking about, well, you know, it would be great. We should set this up. We'll get some experts to do this. We'll pay experts. The key will be keeping Monsanto in the background so so not to affect the credibility of the organization. I mean, this this is what they do. It's very smart, but it's aimed at deceiving the public and deceiving policymakers. And that's, you know, all fair in politics, I guess, in public policy, as long as you're being transparent about it. But when you're hiding funding and hiding relationships specifically to fool the public, you know, that's what I think is not fair and is unforgivable. And the public has a right to know. I mean, they do.
Recently, the University of Utah professor set up the secret summit. We called it the Slaughter Summit because it was an invitation only, but the only people that were invited were people that are pro-horse slaughter, you know, and then the public was excluded, everyone else. But they had members of the Bureau of Land Management there, you know, so it's like a secret meeting that our public officials, the taxpayer pays for them to go to these things, you know, and then we don't know what's going on behind closed doors. We don't know who all the people were. So it's kind of, you know, I was seeing a lot of parallels in what I've seen dealing with our issue when I was reading your book. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about Crop Life America?
Well, yeah, I mean, Crop Life is a lobbying
arm. Or Crop Life International?
Well, Crop Life International, Crop Life America, it's kind of one and the same, just a different, you know, scope of action and interest. But CropLife is a lobbying arm for the agrochemical industry. And in Washington, D.C., CropLife is a very powerful voice. And, you know, they have been instrumental, for instance, in keeping on the market chlorpyrifos just this year, which was scheduled to be banned. It's an insecticide that Dow Chemical, you know, is the key supplier of, and it makes Dow Chemical a lot of money. But it's been found to be dangerous to children in particular, to affect their neurodevelopment and particularly to be harmful to them if their mothers are exposed to it while they're pregnant. And, you know, it's dangerous. It's been banned from household use. It was supposed to be banned this year from farming, but Crop Life and Dow Chemical, you know, weighed on EPA and the new Trump administration and asked them to keep it on the market, and they did. And, you know, CropLife has lobbied on behalf of Monsanto very heavily in favor of glyphosate. So, you know, they're just one of many powerful, you know, tools, I suppose, employed by the chemical industry.
Can you give – I know you've talked to a lot of scientists at the EPA, and there's some good people you know, trying, they're good people. Can you give us some examples of studies by government scientists, government agency scientists that have possibly been suppressed or them talking about it with the public has been suppressed?
Yeah, so what you've seen is, and this has been a problem going back for decades if you track back, and they refer to it as scientific integrity. You know, scientists who do their own research on certain issues, and it's not EPA necessarily, it's EPA, USDA, scientists who work and toil away for, you know, decades and study different things like soil health or bee populations or, you know, the impacts of certain chemicals, pesticides on bees and on butterflies and on weeds and on, you know, this is their life's work is to really study and explain and publish and discuss these issues that are key to agriculture and food production and environmental health and human health. And there are many examples where if their research doesn't dovetail with a corporate agenda or challenges a corporate agenda or a corporate interest, they find their reports edited or suppressed, or they're not allowed to go to conferences to speak about them. You know, they're demoted. I mean, there are many, many examples of that. And, you know, there have been a few. There was a one from USDA not too long ago who kind of filed a whistleblower lawsuit and came out against, you know, and tried to expose this. But many scientists, the ones I talked to, like, they're afraid. I mean, they, you know, they don't like what's going on, but they need their jobs. And so,
yeah, they need their paycheck. Yeah.
So, And we talked to some of them, obviously, in the book. You know that.
Jonathan Lundgren, I think, was one. Isn't he still, didn't he leave the EPA and he's doing studies on his own now?
Yes, he's the one who came out and filed the whistleblower lawsuit in 2015, I guess that was. And yes, he had to leave. He couldn't be that vocal and stay, I think. So he had to leave. But there are others, some who are speaking using their name and some who still can't do that.
Can you tell us about the rise of superweeds?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's sort of what we discussed earlier. With this widespread use of glyphosate, weeds became resistant. And we now have the experts estimate over 70 million acres really around the U.S. farmland where farmers are struggling to combat these superweeds. And, when I first heard farmers start talking about this, more than a decade ago, 15, 20 years ago, I was like, what? So the weed's hard to kill. How big of a deal could that be? But when you go in the fields and you see what they're talking about, these things can be taller than we are, they can get really tall and really hard to fight. And if a farmer's not just super on top of it, he can lose his crop. Farmers in the South, in particular, some of the farmers in cotton growing states have just been decimated by this problem and really struggling, some of them sending out hand laborers to hand weed fields for crying out loud, which we haven't done. But it's a problem. And the industry and the EPA are working hard to try to figure out what to do about that now.
Can you tell us about high volatility?
Dicamba. I think you're talking about, dicamba, and this is, of course, one of the herbicides that has been combined with glyphosate now to try to kill weeds, right, because they're so resistant. So Monsanto's, brilliant strategy was, let's just develop dicamba-tolerant crops that'll be also tolerant to glyphosate, and we'll combine glyphosate and dicamba and spray it all over it, and then we'll be great. Well, a lot of people said, no, this is a really bad idea. And I wrote about that at Reuters because dicamba is known to not be, to not stay where you spray it, is sort of the best way to explain it. So if you spray it on your farm,
it drifts easily into other fields, right?
Under certain conditions. So if you spray it on your farm and you have purchased these special GMO crops, and you spray it, well, that's good. But your neighbor down the road who's got a peach orchard, or watermelon or tomatoes, or even he's grown the same crop as you, but it's not GMO, well, that dicamba is going to hurt his crop. And people knew this. We know this about dicamba. But Monsanto said, no, we have a new formulation. It'll be fine. It'll be great. And anyway, it hasn't been fine. It hasn't been great. And so lots of farmers have lost crops and they filed complaints and there are lawsuits now. And Arkansas has tried to ban it during, the warm months when it's more likely to be volatile, but Monsanto was suing Arkansas to, saying you can't ban it. It's a whole nother big blow up. So,
What happened with labeling efforts? Can you tell everybody a little bit about that?
Well, are you referring to in California where they to label it as a known carcinogen, or were we talking about GMO labeling?
I think it was just yesterday. It's been this past week that Monsanto and the National Association of Wheat Growers and Corn Growers and a bunch of other groups they sued California,
right?
Because they don't want that.
They'll sue everybody. Yeah. So, California moved to label glyphosate as a known carcinogen, and they have done that. And the labeling requirements take effect this next year. So, Monsanto has sued California directly, and that now what they're also trying to do is get a federal legislation in place that would ban states like California, that would ban all states from such labeling requirements, so that you wouldn't have a state that would be able to require something like that. It would have to be done at a federal level. You know, they're pulling out all the stops to try to keep this chemical from being labeled as a carcinogen.
What do you think about the pending, I guess it's pending, merger of Bayer and Monsanto?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting on many, many different levels, right? So they had hoped to have that done by now. It's about a $65 billion deal to merge this very large German company with our, you know, very large American company. And, you know, there's been a big outcry because farmers and others feel like, well, if you take these two powerhouses who control seeds and chemicals and you put them together, you're going to have an even more powerful company that could really, you know, raise prices, limit choices for farmers, you know, a market domination that many people in the agricultural communities find very worrisome. So, you know, we'll see. European regulators are pushing back a little bit, and it's delayed the deal. But the companies still feel like they can get this done in 2018. So we have to wait and see what happens, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. What's interesting, you know, I've been to Monsanto's headquarters in St. Louis, and I was expecting a big building. I wasn't expecting something that looked like a university campus. They have their own power station. It was huge, you know. And then right outside Davis, California, they have like one of their biggest seed growing. It's a little town outside of Davis, and they have their biggest seed growing place in the world. So they have all these greenhouses where they're growing their seeds. One thing I think people don't realize too, a lot of these field tests that are done are open air field tests. And what I found out was the USDA doesn't even really keep track of if there's accidental releases in an environment, or they didn't even know where some of them were. You know, it's very, the USDA has been very sloppy about keeping an eye on these things. So anyhow, Carrie, what's being done now, and what can be done to improve food safety and the environment? You know, we've already got all this glyphosate out there in the soil. How long does it stay in the soil?
Well, that depends on who you ask, of course. I mean, soil scientists that I've talked to, and including, you know, one who was with USDA for many, 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 many years, decades, say it does. I mean, it not only lingers in the soil, but it changes the microbiome within the soil, and can have harmful impacts on the beneficial, you know, microbes in the soil that are needed for plants and insects and things. And, you know, so they're really concerned about this. But, you know, gosh, that's a big question. Like, what can be done? You know, I mean, I think we are seeing that our own government, our regulators, our farmers, you know, at the United Nations, they're recognizing that there's a need for what they refer to as agroecology. You know, trying to better understand and alter practices in a way that protects the broader ecosystem, you know, the environment as a whole, as opposed to just thinking short term, next season, how much am I going to yield, you know, whatever pesticides I need to put on the ground to get there, you know, that'll be worth it. Really trying to look at a more long-term sustainable future. So the USDA right now has a program, and they're out there talking to farmers to encourage them to reduce pesticide use and do things like rotate their crops more, which is good for the soil, use cover crops, do other things. Food companies are putting in place sort of incentives to encourage farmers, you know, to do the same thing, sort of reduce pesticide use. There are grain handling companies, big ones that are starting to say, hey, we're not going to take your grain, Mr. Farmer, if you've sprayed glyphosate on it right before you harvest it. you know, so people are becoming aware and they're making changes, and that's what we need. I mean, that's what the book calls for. I'm not, you know, a global expert in how we should alter policy and improve agriculture, but there are a lot of really good ideas out there and a lot of really smart people. We just need to pay attention and sort of give the support to those voices that maybe aren't as loud and powerful as the chemical industry is, so that we can restore balance and have a healthier future.
Well, yeah, and even in your book, you were talking that the USGS has found glyphosate in U.S. waterways, and what shocked me that it was in 30% of the lakes, ponds, and wetland areas. So,
yeah,
which makes sense since there's ponds all over.
Yeah.
And if the BLM sprang it all over the place,
drinking
too.
Water. Yeah. I mean, it's, as I say, it's pervasive. It's the most widely used. It's not the most dangerous. It's not the only one, obviously, but the pervasiveness of it is what requires the scrutiny.
Yeah. And doesn't the U.S. allow the highest levels of glyphosate in our food?
Yeah. So we have the regulators set what they call maximum residue levels or MRLs limits. Europe has the same thing. This is sort of a benchmark for what we're going to say is okay in terms of pesticide residues in our foods. And I mean, the U.S. says higher levels are okay than Europe does in many foods for glyphosate and for other pesticides. So it's what's interesting and I guess alarming also is that they don't just decide that and then they stay there. You know, they raise them. If the chemical industry comes in and says, oh, we think you should raise this allowable level, this maximum level, you know, many times EPA says, okay, and it happens. And we've seen that just in 2013 again. So,
You
know, the industry and the EPA tell us, don't worry about pesticide residues in your foods. Don't worry about it. You're good. It's fine. But more and more scientists are disagreeing with that and saying it's not fine. It's a reason to be concerned, and we need to be on top of it and studying the implications for health and disease, you know, from these dietary exposures.
Well, in two, GE alfalfa is even a common food for livestock. So that means that's being sprayed with glyphosate. The livestock are eating it, and so there's even, you know, it's even getting to us from that route, it seems, besides the fact that it's in the air and the water and the soil. Aren't the bulk of toxicology tests done using only the active ingredient and not other things that are combined with it?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we see, but that's what, again, is required by the EPA. They really want the studies and the research looking at the active ingredients. So there's much less required related to formulations than there is on active ingredients. And maybe that will change as well. There's discussion about changing that approach.
Yeah. Well, I think you were talking a little bit about POEA, and that's, I think it's found up in Roundup. Isn't that damaging to cells?
Well, yeah, there's been research. Again, this is one of the surfactants that we talked about, you know, that's been shown if you put this into Roundup or other formulations that it could be much more toxic or dangerous than glyphosate alone. Now, Europe has really banned or, you know, moved away from POEA, and Monsanto has had to come up with other options to use in Roundup recently because Europe has said, POEA is too dangerous and we don't want it in these formulations.
In your book, you talked about what's happened to the monarch butterfly. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's just one more example of the impact on the environment. We know that we have seen a big decline in populations of monarch butterfly, sort of this iconic, you know, North American species, and it's directly tied to glyphosate use because all this heavy glyphosate use has essentially wiped out the food for young monarchs. So, you know, the government and Monsanto and others are really working hard to try to turn that around and restore sort of a monarch butterfly habitat and put efforts into that, because that's a loss that no one wants. I mean, they're a pollinator. They're a key pollinator. Not perhaps as important to food production as bees are, you know, again, something that we would rather not lose if we don't have to.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned about Hawaii in your book. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happened in Hawaii with these pesticides?
Yeah, Hawaii is really sort of a sad story, isn't it? Because, you know, we all think of beautiful Hawaiian islands and it's paradise and we go there on vacation and the people who live there are, gosh, the luckiest people in the world. Well, it's also become a real hotspot for these chemical and seed companies to test out their products because it's, you know, year round, it's wonderful climate. And so they've, you know, some of the people in some of the islands are just really, you know, being immersed now in these pesticides, and many of them are known to be so dangerous that they're called restricted use pesticides, or RUPs.
Mm-hmm.
So the people of Hawaii have been trying to fight back and trying to get a handle on, you know, what's being sprayed, how much is being sprayed, you know, some kind of restrictive activities on the chemical companies there, but so far they have not been very successful.
Mm-hmm. And just quickly, you also brought up Florida citrus crop. Can you just briefly tell our listeners what happened there?
Yeah, I mean, people may not know it, but the citrus crop, you know, our oranges and others have really been decimated, much like the monarch butterfly, but production has really been in decline in recent years. And this has been attributed to a disease that has taken hold that farmers have been struggling very hard with. And there are sort of a body of research theory that believes that it's this extensive use of glyphosate that, again, has affected the health of the soil, which leaves these plants vulnerable to disease.
Mm-hmm.
And they are researching ways to improve the soil. You just restore the health of the soil and sort of remove this pesticide-laden, you know, approach, and that the citrus groves improve. So, but that, again, is a debate because the pesticide companies say, no, it doesn't have anything to do with it. And their answer is to develop sort of a GMO tree, a GMO, genetically altered approach.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Debates everywhere you turn.
I know. And one thing I really was glad to read in your book, PEER, the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, they filed a legal petition with the USDA demanding the agency do more to protect its scientists. And I was really glad to hear about that. Yeah. So,
again, they're not being super successful at this point. But, yeah, I mean, there are people out there working.
Yeah, at least they're making it public and trying to do it. Well, anyhow, we've barely touched on your book is so amazing, and I want to thank you so much for writing this book. I can't rave about your book enough. I'm telling everybody about it.
Thank you. I do hope people read it.
It's a must read. Yeah, it's a must read. And if people, I think they can get it both on your website at carriegillum.com. It's on Amazon. And if you, in our radio promo, if you click on the word whitewash, it'll take you to Amazon. But at the bottom of the promo, I have a link set up to Carrie's website at carriegillum.com. We're down to our last couple minutes, Carrie. This has been a fascinating show. Very important work you're doing. You're my hero. I'd like to thank you for taking time to be on our show today. Well, okay. But
thank you.
Thank you.
And
well,
I appreciate that. I'm
journalists, and I'm so disappointed in so many newspapers. Well, they don't have the money to have investigative journalists anymore. So the work you do is so important.
You have to say, I mean, I think journalists, yes, I agree. It takes a lot of time to read a lot of documents and just drill down. And I mean, it's not easy and it's not fun. And, but you know, I'm old enough now and I've come to find it's really important. And so I've been able to pull a lot together, but, you know, there are good people out there. We just all need to kind of try to educate ourselves and be as informed as we can, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Well, anyhow, everybody, I want you to check out U.S. Right to Know organization. It's at usrtk.org. Check out Carrie Gillum's website, carriegillum.com. You can go to justicepesticides.org. Carrie's on their board of directors. I'd like to thank our producer, Marty Oakley, for producing our show today, and let all of you know there are two other shows on TS Radio. They're Voices Carried for Animals on Tuesday nights, hosted by Debbie Dahmer, and Whistleblowers on Thursday nights, hosted by Marty Oakley. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today, and thank you, Carrie. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.